Well, a lot of us have lived long enough to face those times when it seems like all is dark. But I want to tell you, you can trust in the dark. God sees in the dark, and you can trust Him in the dark. Praise God. Amen. Well, again, it's so good to see all of you here tonight. I thought as I was looking across the congregation tonight, I sometimes think about the things that were part of my spiritual formation. And I read something today, and I didn't plan to give it, but if I remember the numbers correctly, they said we only remember long-term 17% of what happens to us. And if that number is correct, I need to go back in the book I read it in and make sure I'm right when I say that. But 17%, that means that, what is that, 83% would it be? 83% we forget. It just kind of goes off into Never Never Land, that big black hole, you know. I'm kind of thinking that by the time you reach my age, the number is even higher than 83% that goes off into that black hole. But when I look back and see the things that were part of my spiritual formation, there are high points of the movings of God that marked me forever. And one of the things that that you want to be a part of your spiritual formation is revival. And I commend the families that have brought your families night after night to revival. Because, you know, you may feel like, well, I don't get much out of it. The kids keep me busy and distract me and all of that. But bring them anyway. And you may feel like you're tired, but come anyway. And you have done that and night after night. And I commend you for it. Because this is part of our spiritual formation. There's an awful lot of other things pushing in, aren't there? In our lives. There are an awful lot of things trying to gain a foothold and trying to be a part of the picture. But God's trying to help us, and I believe He has been helping us in this revival, and I'm very, very grateful. It is so good to see Mark and Catherine and their family with us tonight. I can tell you this, I go a lot back, further back than you do, Brother Ziegler. I go back to when Mark was born. And then I especially go back to 1976. And Mark was about that tall. And he was a good-looking little miniature groom or Bible bearer in my wedding. Almost be this summer, be 40 years ago, Mark. I can't believe that. But I have just been thrilled to see. I remember, Mark, I don't know if you'll remember this, but I remember when you were at GBS and I sensed that God was helping you and God was forming you and preparing you. And I said, Mark, how's your love life coming? You got your eye on any girls? And I was just probing around a little bit, but I was asking because I cared. And he said, well, I've got my eye on a girl by the name of what was her name, Mark? No. By the name of Catherine Bittinger. And I said, well, I'm trying to think. And he gave me a few, and I said, oh, yeah, I think I know who you're talking about. I really didn't know Catherine at that time. And Catherine has proven to be a wonderful helpmeet for Mark, and they have a beautiful family. And I just rejoice at what God has done using them and is using them today. It's so good to have you with us, Mark. Amen. Mark's dad and my dad are brothers. But Mark's dad and I are closer in age than his dad and my dad were in age. So it's so good to be a part of Mark's life and his family. I want to read from three places tonight if you want to follow. I want to read first in Galatians chapter 6. Galatians chapter 6, and I'll just read verse 9, and then 2 Thessalonians chapter 3 and verse 13. And then I'll read three verses from Hebrews chapter 12. Galatians chapter 6, Verse 9 says, "And let us not be weary in well-doing, for in due season we shall reap if we faint not." Another rendering of that says, "Never let us grow tired of doing what is right, for after a while we'll reap a harvest of blessing if we don't get discouraged and give up." 2 Thessalonians 3:13 says, "But ye, brethren, be not weary in well-doing." Hebrews chapter 12 and verse 1, "Wherefore, seeing also we also are compassed about with so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which doth so easily beset us, and let us run with patience the race that is set before us, looking unto Jesus." That's good advice, friends, looking unto Jesus. Let me ask you, where are your eyes tonight? You say, "Well, preacher, I'm discouraged." Looking unto Jesus. You say, "My prayer hasn't been answered." Looking unto Jesus. "But I've got troubles at home." Looking unto Jesus. "My husband isn't saved." Looking unto Jesus. "My kids are wayward." Looking unto Jesus. "I failed." Looking unto Jesus. That's good advice, friends. There is not a spiritual failure that didn't begin with getting your eyes off of Jesus. Looking unto Jesus, the author says. He's the author and finisher. I love that. He's the author, but he's the finisher. He who begun a good work is going to complete it. He's the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is set down at the right hand of the throne of God. And here it is again. "For consider him looking unto Jesus. Consider him that endured such contradiction of sinners against himself, lest," and here he's telling us why we need to keep our eyes on Jesus, "lest ye be wearied and faint in your mind." Lest you get weary. Lest you lose heart. Lest you wear out with despondency. Lest you become exhausted. Lest you faint and fail and lose your purpose and your courage. If I understand the exhortation of these passages of Scripture correctly, we're being exhorted to fight against spiritual exhaustion. I may be talking to a tired congregation tonight. I'm not even going to ask if you're tired. Because it won't help any to admit it, will it? But I'm not talking about physical weariness. All of us face that at times. And on Saturday night of revival, of course we're tired. But we're talking about a spiritual condition. We're being exhorted to fight against spiritual exhaustion, spiritual tiredness. Don't get weary. Don't become exhausted. Don't lose your purpose and your courage. Evidently, there's a grave danger of that very thing happening to us. It was true in Paul's day. If you noticed, I read from three different New Testament books. That represents three different churches, Galatians and Hebrews and Thessalonians. Evidently, there was a great danger of becoming weary in well-doing. And Paul says, don't be tired. Don't become weary. In January of 1982... there was a story that hit the headlines. You may remember the story. I told this story at Hope Sound Camp, and a lady came up to me after the service, and I told about Air Florida Flight 727 that left Florida somewhere and had landed in Washington, D.C. area airport. And then was taking off from Washington, D.C. She said, "Preacher, my husband was supposed to be the pilot on that plane. And because he had seniority, he opted for another flight that was easier. And When that plane came down, my mother-in-law called me and she was screaming in the phone, where's, I don't remember his name now, but calling his name, where is he? Where is he? She said, well, he's on a flight going to Dallas or something like that. And she said, oh my, have you heard the news? Flight 727, 30 seconds into the flight, realized it was not gaining altitude. There was an accumulation of ice and snow on the aircraft. It began to lose altitude in that big city area. It hit the 14th Street Bridge on I-385 and crashed against that bridge and broke into pieces and plunged into the icy waters of the Potomac River. A rescue effort was organized very quickly. Some military helicopters were rushed in. There were survivors clinging to the wreckage of the plane. Several months later, I read the story in the Reader's Digest about the rescue effort told by one of the rescue helicopter pilots. He said he came down over the tail wreckage of the tail section of that plane, and there were survivors clinging to that wreckage. And he said he lowered down over a gentleman later identified as Arlen Williams Jr. And he said, I came down over the gentleman, but he began to wave me aside and pointed to someone else nearby. And he said, I saw he was saying, take them first. And he said, I moved over and rescued a lady and took her to shore. I came back again. And again, he waved me aside and I took someone else to safety. And I can't remember now whether it was two or three times that happened. But finally, the pilot said, I came back and lowered over the tail section of that plane. Visibility was poor, but he said, I knew I was at the right place. I had just been here two or three times before. But he said, as I looked to my horror, the man that had waved me aside was gone. Later, it was identified that this man was the only one that died not from injuries of the crash. But he let go. Moments before he was to be rescued, he let go. He just became too weary to hold on any longer. He became overcome with the elements, the shock, the weather, the injury, the weariness, all that put together. And minutes before he was to be taken to life-saving safety, he let go and he lost his life. I am persuaded, friends, that there is a spiritual climate in our day that is creeping into the church world again and again. A certain spiritual exhaustion, spiritual elements, spiritual injury, spiritual shock, and it's causing some people to let go before the rescue comes. The climate is lowering spiritual resistance and causing spiritual exhaustion to creep over us and clouding our purpose and our courage and wearing us down and causing us to become so weary and well-doing until we're throwing up our hands and giving up. Friends, we can't afford to give up too quickly. We dare not do it. I believe this exhortation is a very relevant one for this generation. Don't be weary in well-doing. Fight spiritual exhaustion. Jesus is coming. Don't give up before the trumpet sounds, moments before the rescue. As I have traveled around the different parts of the kingdom and been in the ministry almost 40 years now, I have to tell you tonight that I've seen too many people that just got weary of the pressure and tired of the criticism and tired of the fighting and tired of the struggle, tired of the cost. Sometimes people get tired of keeping a good spirit when others are not keeping a good spirit. Sometimes they get weary of criticism. Sometimes they get weary of paying the price. Sometimes they get weary of just the battle, tired of waiting for the harvest. And today they are a spiritual statistic. Three things I see. I probably won't cover them all tonight because I don't want to keep you late. This is Saturday night, and I'm going to preach short. Anybody believe that? That's what I was afraid of. I see the exhortation, be not weary. I see the example, consider him that endured. I see the end, we shall reap if we faint not. The exhortation, be not weary. Friends, the devil is doing his best to try to wear us down and cause us to become spiritually exhausted, spiritually tired. What's he trying to get us tired of? I think he's trying to get us tired of the spiritual battle, the spiritual warfare, the spiritual fight, if you please. Have you ever noticed how many times in the scripture the Christian walk is likened to a spiritual battle? You ever noticed it? Let's look at it quickly. 2 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 3. Paul said to Timothy, "Thou therefore endure hardness as a good soldier of Jesus Christ." He said, "No man that warreth entangleth himself with the affairs of this life." Paul, writing to the Ephesians in chapter 6 and verse 11, "Put on the whole armor of God that ye may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil. We wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities and powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this world, against spiritual wickedness in high places." And we need to look at that passage. We need to remember God says, we're not wrestling against flesh and blood. We're not fighting each other, but there is an enemy that is fighting every one of us. "Wherefore, take unto you the whole armor of God, that you may be able to stand against the evil day." Paul said to Timothy in 6:12, 1 Timothy 6:12, "Fight the good fight of faith. Lay hold on eternal life." He said to the Corinthians, "For though we walk in the flesh, we do not war after the flesh. For the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but they're mighty through God to the pulling down of stronghold." Timothy, he said, war a good warfare. Now please understand, I'm not talking about a hard and harsh and ugly attitude or a fighting spirit among God's people. There's never a place for that in anybody's Christian walk. But what I am telling you, that it is a battle to walk with God. It is a battle to be a righteous man in an unrighteous world. Many times it's just a good old-fashioned knockdown, drag-out fight with the devil. It's a battle. I remember many years ago, guess more years than I care to remember, but I was in grade school. I was in about the fourth grade, and I went to Christian school, and I don't know if you've had this trouble over at Bedford Christian School or not, but one day somebody walked into the playground with two bright red pairs of boxing gloves, and some of us decided we needed to give it a try. I launched a boxing career in the fourth grade. I don't know whether I had an exalted opinion of my ability or just what it was, but, you know, it takes two to tangle, you know. And so I had on the boxing gloves, and the guy on the other end of this proposition was my oldest brother. Say, that would have made him in the eighth grade, me in the fourth grade, he in the eighth grade. I'd seen boys on the street corner dance around in a circle and fight and shadow box and even really fight sometimes in Cincinnati. But I don't know if I'd ever hit somebody seriously in my whole life, even my brothers. But I began to dance around in a circle, and all the kids had gathered around. The only problem with that fighting, that boxing match, was he landed the first punch. He hit me squarely in the nose with a haymaker. I mean, I instantly had the worst nosebleed I've ever had in all my life. I got tired of that fight real fast. I went into and out of the boxing business in the fourth grade without ever landing a punch. I have no time for the sport of boxing, if it can even be called a sport. It seems mighty inhumane and barbaric to me. But many years ago, some of you may have known Paul Eager, that pastored up here in Shelbyville, Indiana, for many years. I had a meeting with Paul Eager early in my ministry. He's gone on to heaven now. And everything I knew of Paul Eager, he seemed to be such a meek and mild sort of guy. But he told an illustration from his own life. He said before he was converted, he loved to box. He loved to fight. I really couldn't put it with Paul Eager. Now, I've heard Marshall Smart say he, before he was saved, he loved to fight. And I can see that. Marshall Smart said, "I'd get in a barroom fight, and if I tasted blood," he said, "I became a wild man." I could believe that one too. But Paul Eager said, "I loved to fight." And he said, I decided I wanted to have a career in boxing. And he said, "I was doing real well." Said, "I'd won a bunch of fights in my weight division. Finally, I'd worked my way up, and there was a championship fight coming." And he said, "I had a trainer, and I was going to the gym, and I was training, and I was working, and I was sacrificing. Others would do other things in the evenings and on weekends, and I was in the gym. I was getting ready for the championship fight." He said, "I wanted to win it." He said, "The day came, and I climbed in the ring and my opponent climbed into the ring, and he said the bell sounded and we headed for the center of the ring. He said we began to let her fly, and he said I real quickly realized that my opponent was really good. He said he was really battering me, and he said several rounds passed, and he said I was losing hope in the fight. I was getting tired of the fight. I was saying he's too much for me, and finally the bell rang, and he said I staggered to my corner and kind of slumped on the chair, and he said the trainer began to dry my face off with a towel and squirt a little juice in my mouth, and he said, look at me, son. He said, I want to tell you something, son. This is the championship fight. He said, you've been training for this for weeks. And he said, I've noticed that your opponent has some weaknesses. And he began to tell him what the weaknesses were. And he said, I'll tell you what I want you to do. He said, I want you to climb back in that ring, and I want you to reach back in your reserves and your training and what you've prepared for this moment. And he said, I want you to pull out all the stops, and I want you to give it one more good round. I think you can do it, son. Paul Eager said, through bleary eyes, he talked me into it, and the bell rang quicker than I thought it should, and I staggered to my feet and staggered to the center of the ring. But he said those words began to reverberate in my mind. This is for the championship. This is what you've been giving yourself for. This is what you've been living for. And he said, suddenly I reached back in my reserves and began to pull out all the reserve strength that I could find, and it rang in my ear, the opponent's weak. And he said, I began to slug it out, and lo and behold, the trainer was right. He said, in that round, I scored a knockout and I won the fight. I have an idea that I'm talking to some people tonight that have heard reverberating in your ears all of the accusations and suggestions of the enemy that you're not going to make it, and you become weary and well-doing, and sometimes we're ready to throw in the towel. Friend, don't you do it. There's a day coming when it's going to be worth it to stay true and keep on fighting through. I don't know how you're going to make it, but God in heaven knows how you're going to make it. Keep on fighting the battle. Don't give up. Don't get weary. Don't get weary of the battle. We can't afford to give up. What are we fighting against? I want to talk to you about one thing in particular. I think one of the major things I'm seeing in this generation is fighting against spiritual drowsiness, spiritual sleepiness. Fighting against spiritual drowsiness. You men know what I'm talking about. You work hard all day. You come in tired at night. Pull your boots off at the door. Walk over to the lazy boy, sit down. You can smell supper cooking. You pick up the newspaper. You begin to read a few headlines. And before you know it, the newspaper hits you in the face. What did you do? You drifted off to sleep. Have you ever had to fight sleep? Have you ever analyzed sleep a little? I'm the kind of person that can sleep anywhere. I get it honest. My mother was the kind of person that could sleep anywhere. My mother told the story about a lady that came to see her for some counsel. They sat down across from each other at the dining room table, and the lady was telling her her woes, and you guessed it, mother went to sleep. And suddenly she woke up, and that lady, she was horrified. I've seen my mother when all the kids would come home and grandkids. My mother was the kind of grandmother that said, oh, don't worry about the house, we'll clean it up when they're gone, let them have fun in the house. And the Stettler grandkids could play cowboys and Indians through the living room. And about middle of the afternoon, mother had been up early and up late and working hard, taking care of the family and cooking meals and all that. About middle, when it got time for a nap, you didn't have to ask my mother if she could, or she didn't have to ask you if she could. She just turned her head sideways and opened her mouth good, and she'd take a nap. Kids playing cowboys and Indians out in the living room floor. I remember years ago, well, let me back up here just a minute. I've gone to sleep in a recliner. I can sleep in good in a recliner. I can sleep in a straight back chair. I can just kind of lock my head in and sit there straight up in a doctor's office and go to sleep. You know how the dentist gives you a shot or just does a little something and goes off in another room? I've gone to sleep in a dentist chair more than once. I've gone to sleep driving. I've gone to sleep in church. Some of you can do that. I went to sleep standing up one time, working all night, and my knees buckled and I caught myself before I hit the ground. I remember years ago I was moving to Alabama. My wife and I had just been married short time, about a year. I was taking my first church. My parents lived in Salem, Ohio at the time, 275 miles from Cincinnati. We lived in Cincinnati. I had gone up for the weekend to see my parents before we moved to Alabama. I left early Monday morning from Salem, Ohio, headed for Cincinnati. When I pulled into Cincinnati shortly after noon, there were two preachers there. My brother-in-law and another preacher had a U-Haul trailer and a Dodge Maxi van, and they were trying to break into my apartment, trying to get my stuff loaded. And I said, wait, fellas, wait, I've got a key. And so we opened the apartment and began to load our stuff. They got everything loaded, and they said, well, we're heading for Alabama. It's about 5 or 6 o'clock in the evening. We cleaned up the apartment. I'd loaded everything else we had. I looked at Regina and said, we don't have a mattress to sleep on. We don't have the apartment's cleaned out. What are we going to do? We didn't have any money. Didn't have the money to get a motel. I said, well, let's just head for Alabama. So we did. About 2 o'clock the next morning, I was getting so sleepy. I think I was going to sleep without every 10th turn of the tire, you know. My wife would pat my face and I'd go to sleep with her patting. She'd pinch my leg and I'd go to sleep with her pinching. Finally, she said, let's sing a song. And so we started singing a song and I went to sleep in the middle of the verse. I'm not exaggerating. Finally, my wife said, let's talk about something controversial. So we started an argument. You men aren't going to believe this, but I went to sleep arguing. Tried to do a little better since. But you know, I've learned something about fighting sleep. If I can, I don't know whether it's psychological, mental, physical. If I can just keep my fight. If I ever lose my fight. Last summer, I closed Penns Creek Camp on a Sunday night. And I said, a friend of mine saw me throwing things in the car and he said, are you leaving tonight? I said, yeah, I've got a full tank of gas. I can make it till after midnight and not buy on Sunday and I'm going to head home. Well, I did. About 5 o'clock in the morning, I was about an hour from home. Man, I was sleepy. I couldn't keep awake. I could not do it. I thought, I've only got an hour. What am I going to do? I just decided I'd start talking to myself. I mean, right out loud. I mean, louder than I'm talking to you. I'd say, you see that ditch over there, Darrell Stetler? You're not going in that ditch. I'm kidding. I'm not exaggerating. You see that car over there, Darrell? You're not hitting that car. You're going to stay awake, son. There are dangers out here. You might die on this road. You're not going to die tonight. You're going to stay awake till you get home. And I just kept talking just like it. I mean, I was doing it just like I was preaching. I was serious about it right there in the car all by myself. But I stayed awake. You know, I have an idea. There may be some sitting right here tonight that need to be talking to themselves just about like that. There are dangers down that road. You're not going down there. You better stop it here. You better quit what you're... You better take stock of what's going on. You better stay awake. I'm not doing it. I'm going to stay awake. I'm not going to sleep spiritually. Amen. You better start talking that way. You expect to make it. You ever analyzed what happens to you when you get real sleepy? You begin to relax. You loosen your grip. That's why the newspaper hits you in the face. You don't hold anything tightly when you get sleepy unless you're having a nightmare. You let go when you go to sleep. Do you get the spiritual implications of that simple little lesson? You get spiritually sleepy and you begin to turn loose and let go of things you should never let go of. You begin to relax. Things that were very, very, very important to you become a whole lot less important when you get sleepy. Good judgment flees. Reason gets unclear. Becomes easy to rationalize. Priorities get all out of arrangement. You begin to veer off track. I remember years ago when I was pastoring in Alabama, Brother Egan called me one day and said, I'm going to a revival up in Wind Gap, Pennsylvania. That's clear up not far from where Mr. Sickler's from, out there in eastern Pennsylvania. We were in Alabama. He said, they want somebody to sing. Could you all go? And I said, well, I think maybe we could. So we planned the meeting. Brother Egan was always the kind of person that he would say, yeah, we can start on Monday night. Yeah, we'll be there. Well, the rest of that story was I was pastoring and I was way down in Alabama and I had a Sunday night service. And he's talking about Wind Gap, Pennsylvania. And so we threw everything in the car after Sunday night and headed up to Pell City where they lived. And we headed up toward Chattanooga and then hit 81 up across the state of Virginia. I've never in my whole life seen a man that can sleep and drive quite like Brother Egan. I've been a passenger, he the driver, and I looked over and he's driving down the road with his eyes closed. Made me just a little nervous. He was in a separate car because their schedule was not coming back to Alabama. They had another meeting or something. I don't remember the details, but we were traveling. My wife and I and my children, Brother and Sister Egan in the front car. The good thing about it, what I've just said to you is exactly what was happening to Brother Egan. He was relaxing. Good judgment was going out the window. Priorities were getting out of arrangement. He was veering off track, but at least he was slowing down. We drove 45 miles an hour down the interstate. I don't know how far that night. I could see him stretch one arm out like this. I was following behind, my light shining into his car. He'd stretch one arm. He'd scratch his head. I couldn't see Sister Egan at all. While I was watching, an interstate has two lanes designed for travel. It has a solid white line, then it has a shoulder, a berm over here that's not really designed for travel. And while I watched, he began to drift off onto the shoulder of the road, the berm. Two tires across that white line. I thought, what should I do? Should I flash my light? Should I pass him? I was afraid he'd wake up and turn the wrong way, you know. While I was thinking about that, my kids were asleep in the back seat. My wife was asleep in the front seat. Sister Egan was asleep in that front seat. Brother Egan was asleep driving. And I was watching. And he went two more tires off. And he was driving down the shoulder of the road just like that's where he belonged. Do you think he was aware of the dangers? No. Do you think he didn't care about his wife anymore? And her safety? Of course not. He cared as much as he ever had. But what was wrong? He was asleep. It's amazing what happens to you when you go to sleep. We've stayed this week in Sister Ziegler's father's fifth wheel out here. Brought back so many wonderful memories. Years of evangelism when I pulled a 40-foot fifth wheel trailer and even sitting there in the trailer and feeling that little gentle rock just kind of brought back great memories to me. Thinking about it this afternoon, sitting there. We parked our trailer in all kinds of places for 7 years we traveled. Sometimes I backed in one place where when I cranked out my windows on this side, they hit the post of the porch of the parsonage. I couldn't slip through between my slide out and the church wall on that side. He came right straight out to the sidewalk on the front, and I was touching the back porch on the back. Didn't have much room. We parked one place in Erie, Pennsylvania, where we slept in up over the front of the, was where our bedroom was, and that was right out to the sidewalk in Erie, Pennsylvania. And while we were trying to go to sleep, somebody beat on the side of the trailer, and we sat up in bed, and I peeked out the window. Nobody out there, of course. I had gone to a country church in central Ohio. Real nice little country church. situated on a country crossroads up in flat country up in Ohio. The parsonage was not by the church. The parsonage was in town. This was before cell phones. Some of you don't even remember those days. We parked the trailer behind the church. And as the week progressed, the first night or two, we began to realize we're out here all by ourselves. No phone. Usually we took a phone, we'd take 100 feet of phone wire so we could run it over to the parsonage, you know, and hook into their phone so we had some communication. But there wasn't any phone at the church, and the parsonage wasn't, the pastor lived in town. Made us just a little nervous. Now, you people would know this, but I tell people, when it got dark and the last cars left the parking lot and we were going in the trailer, it was country dark. And you know, country dark's darker than city dark. You do know that, don't you? It is. And my kids were just nervous. They'd say, "Daddy, hurry up, open that door. Get in the trailer. Let's shut that door. Lock it." Friday night, that very thing happened. We talked with the people. Finally, the last car left the church parking lot. My kids were saying, "Daddy, hurry, unlock the door, get in, let's get inside, I'm scared, this is dark out here." And we hurried in and I shut the door and locked the door. Through the week, we had noticed on the opposite corner of this country crossroads was an old mobile home trailer. Coming and going from the church a few times, we had noticed a man with shoulder-length black greasy hair and motorcycle boots and blue jeans, and he'd set his speaker out on the step and play rock music. He wore a t-shirt with monster pictures on it, you know. Kind of a rough looking guy. Saturday morning, we had been in the trailer all night and I was not awake yet. And suddenly, somebody pounded on the door of my trailer. You talk about that little shake. Somebody pounded on the door of a trailer and it kind of goes like this, you know. I sat up in bed. My wife said, "Don't go to the door. Don't go to the door. Don't go to the door." I eased out of bed, trying to not rock the trailer, you know. There were two steps going down into the living room area. I eased down those steps and went over and peeked through the mini blind. Standing at my door was a man with shoulder-length black greasy hair, a t-shirt with a monster picture. He had on blue jeans. He had one of those big chains that went to his wallet. Motorcycle boots. And while I was trying to decide what to do, he pounded again. I was seeing all of these possibilities, you know. And when he knocked the second time, I took a deep breath and I said, "Just a minute." I tried to put all the muscles I could in my voice. I eased the door open just a little, and I said, "May I help you, sir?" He said, I've got a motorcycle that's broke down, and I've got a vehicle, and I've got a trailer to pull the motorcycle, but I don't have a trailer hitch ball, and need to take it to get it worked on, and I noticed you had a trailer hitch ball on your truck. Could I borrow it?" Those are the first words that man ever spoke to me. He got me out of bed speaking. We're out there all by ourselves, and I was thinking, is he just trying to get me outside? I said, "Well, let me get some shoes on and I'll see if we can get it off." And I was ready to close the door, trying to decide, am I going to open this door or am I just going to sit here and hope for the best? I was about to get the door closed and he said, "Sir." I eased the door open and said, "Yes." He kind of had this confused look on his face and he pointed up at the door and he said, "Your keys are in the door." The night before, I had carefully unlocked the door, hurried my kids in, shut the door, and deadbolt locked it and left the keys sticking. You think that bothered me? Not till I woke up. You're unaware of danger. Do you get the spiritual implications of this? Friends, I want to tell you, this is dead serious. You drift off into spiritual sleepiness, and there will be things beginning to make encroachments and inroads into your life that are very, very dangerous, and you don't even see it. Every once in a while, I have people look at me, Brother Ziegler, and say, "Preacher, I don't see anything wrong with that." And I say, "You're kidding. I used to question it. I used to think maybe they were lying to me. I don't think they are anymore. I think they're spiritually asleep. They don't see the danger." Do you see why we need to stay spiritually alert and awake? Be not weary in battling against spiritual tiredness. Listen to the words of Jesus in Mark chapter 13. When Jesus said, "Watch ye therefore, lest coming suddenly he find you sleeping." Oh God. "Watch ye therefore, lest coming suddenly he find us sleeping." The final thing, and I'm going to let you go. Don't get tired of the fight, the battle. Don't get tired of fighting spiritual drowsiness. But finally, don't get tired of waiting for the harvest. You know, there's a reason why God said, "In due season ye shall reap, if you faint not." What he's appealing to is something that is very known to us. And that is the law of sowing and reaping, the law of sowing and of planting and harvest. We understand that principle, don't we? Certainly we do. The principle of in due season. Why do the farmers go out like they do? And right now they're beginning the process. And as soon as it's dry enough, they'll be tilling that soil and spending money to put down the fertilizer and the weed killer and all getting everything ready, putting the seeds in the ground. Why are they doing that? They're doing it for one reason, because they're expecting a harvest. They're expecting a return. And God gives us this spiritual principle and says, if you'll stay alert and not be weary in well-doing, in due season, you'll reap a harvest of spiritual blessing. Oh, friends, if God could help us to get that. I am seeing too many people, moms and dads and pastors and people and laymen and board members and school people. I'm seeing people becoming weary and waiting for the harvest day, waiting for the promise. Many years ago, I've told you I'm a city boy, and I guess that marks me in a country area, doesn't it? But I'll tell you something about this city boy. This city boy likes to grow a garden. I get it, honest, Mark. Your granddaddy and your dad, my dad, like to plant something. I took my first church, and it was a country church, and there's a big garden plot out there. And I thought, man, I've never had a garden before. I'm going to try it. Before it was over, one of those men from that country church said, "Man, this city boy from up north had to come down here and tell us, show us how to grow a garden." God had blessed the garden, and I was grateful. I went to Talladega, Alabama to pastor. We had a big garden. Then the church bought a little piece of ground in the next to the church driveway. We wanted a little buffer zone, so we bought 50 feet into a soybean field. That was 50 feet by 325. We were going to let the farmer just go ahead farming it, but I got to looking at that plot, and I said, "Man, that'd be a good garden." I planted all of it. I mean, I put up 100 dozen ears of corn, I think it was. It was so many, I lost track. We put up 150 quarts of green beans, I think it was, and I planted okra. Do you grow okra around here? Somebody up north called it okra. I planted 4 50-foot rows of okra. I can tell you this, that's enough okra for this whole congregation. I got so tired of cutting okra, you got to cut it about every other day. You know, I got so tired of cutting, I took my mower and mowed the okra down. But because I had such a big spot, I thought, I'd never grown watermelon or cantaloupe before. And I laid off a plot about as big as this whole including that aisle over there, at least as big as this side of the church. Great big old area. And I got me several varieties of watermelon and cantaloupe, and I set my hills out there about 6 feet apart, my rows about 6 feet apart. I planted it down through there, and a little while they were coming up. Now, you've got to understand, I don't really like watermelon. If I eat a watermelon, it's got to be real cold, real sweet, not too many seeds, real hot outside, nothing else to eat, and I'll eat a watermelon. But my wife loves watermelon. She can spit seeds as far as anybody. I've seen her eat a bad watermelon right down to the green. If I eat a watermelon, all I eat's the heart. But I was growing those watermelons, and they were coming good. I like to keep my garden clean. But those vines grow out. And then I went off to camping conference for 2 weeks, and I got back, and weeds were ankle deep all over my melon patch. And I thought, my goodness, it's no use. Finally, weeds were knee-high. One day I kicked around out there in the knee-high weeds, and I was amazed. There were watermelon and cantaloupe everywhere. I saw, as I walked down my last row of corn right next to that patch, one vine had grown over right into that row of corn, and right in that row of corn was a nice big melon growing. I thought, man, I'm going to keep my eye on that thing. I'd go out every morning and check the watermelon, check the garden. You know, one of the things this city boy learned is for a garden to grow right, you've got to look at it several times a day. I'd say to my wife, let's go look at the garden. She said, I looked at it yesterday. Is it not still out there? One morning I went out and I'd been watching that watermelon. Now, I don't need to tell you it's harder to tell. Now, I know somebody will come to me after this service and say, now, the way you tell a watermelon's ready is... But I've heard all of that, and none of it's worked for me. I mean, I can tell when an ear of corn, a green bean, and okra's ready. You know, I can see it, but a watermelon. So I walked down that row of corn, and I saw that melon's about that big, and I thought, oh, boy, this is your day. I picked that watermelon, carried it into the house with a big satisfied smile, laid it on the counter, and was calling my wife as I was splitting it open with a butcher knife, whose sides fell out there like that, and I cut into the heart. She walked into the room, and I gave her a big bite of that watermelon, and I expected to see her face light up, but it didn't really light up like I thought it would. I thought, something's wrong. I dug in there and put a bite in my mouth. I hurried to the trash can and spit mine out. You know what I'd done? I'd gotten in a hurry, gotten tired of waiting for the harvest, and I picked it just a few days too green. Oh God, would you help us to not give up before harvest day? I'm talking to some people that are praying earnestly for some loved one that's unsaved. Don't give up before they're in. Those teenagers that are out there, those children that are out, those loved ones, that husband, wife, mom, dad, don't give up before harvest day. I'm talking to some young parents that, you know, sometimes the world just kind of crashes in around young parents. And I see some young families here tonight. And sometimes all the pressures of children and teenagers and all of that, and it all crashes in. Don't give up. Don't quit. You say, I don't know how I'm going to take another step. I don't know either. But God does. And He'll help you through. I got great encouragement. One church I pastored, a lady had 9 children. In those 9, she had 2 sets of twins. She's 80 years old and in her right mind. I thought, man, if she can do that, I can make it. I only have 4 kids. Don't be weary in well-doing, for in due season. And finally, you know the final application of this, don't you? One of these days, the trumpet's going to sound. And it's going to all be over, Brother Mark. and everything we've labored for and everything we've sacrificed for and all of the things we've trained for and all the revival services we've gone to and all of the prayers we prayed are all going to be piled up, and God's going to bring an eternal harvest. Friend, don't give up before harvest day. In due season you shall reap if you faint not. Be not weary in well-doing. And if I keep praying, I'm going to wear you out so bad you're going to be doing what I'm asking you not to do. I want us to stand together.